From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actress Hope Davis. She starred in About Schmidt and Next Stop Wonderland. Now she's starring in two new films, The Secret Lives of Dentists, adapted from the Jane Smiley novella The Age of Grief, and American Splendor, which is based on Harvey Pekar's series of autobiographical comics. Also, Ken Tucker concludes his series on pop rock bands and reviews a CD by The High Strung. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers what's wrong with the way most modern dictionaries are illustrated. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Republican congressman who bankrolled the recall campaign against California Governor Gray Davis announced today that he's no longer running to replace Davis. NPR's John McChesney says Darrell Issa's tearful withdrawal came as a surprise.
Darrell Issa paid $1.7 million of his own money on this recall campaign. He hired an army of signature gatherers and got almost 1.5 million signatures to recall the governor. So his withdrawal is pretty remarkable, since he's the man who paid for it, almost all of it. And everybody agrees that had Darrell Issa not put his money into this recall campaign, it probably wouldn't have gone anywhere.
NPR's John McChesney. Issa's withdrawal came less than 24 hours after movie star Arnold Schwarzenegger announced that he's a Republican candidate in the recall election. A car bomb exploded today outside the Jordanian embassy in Baghdad. NPR's Ann Garrell says the attack hit hardest at people on the street.
Most of those killed, as many as 11, and those who were severely injured, way more than 50, were not Jordanians, but Iraqi police guards and Iraqis who had been passing by.
Officials in Jordan say evidence from the blast indicated that it was an orchestrated terrorist attack. Jordan supported the U.S.-led war against Saddam Hussein's government. In another part of Baghdad today, a U.S. patrol fought with Iraqis who attacked with rocket-propelled grenades and assault rifles. There were no immediate reports of casualties, but two American soldiers were killed in a separate firefight in Baghdad last night. In Liberia, Nigerian peacekeepers have moved into the heart of Monrovia, where just days ago there was heavy fighting and shelling. President Charles Taylor says he'll hand over power to his vice president and leave the country within a week. NPR's Jason Bobian reports from Monrovia.
Monrovia residents waited for hours to welcome the first convoy of Nigerian peacekeepers as they drove into the capital from the airport. Richard Dua, who now lives with tens of thousands of other refugees in the national soccer stadium, says the international troops are the saviors of Liberia.
In my country, I see peace coming. You see, we have been fighting wars that has no significance. To see brothers fighting one another, killing one another, I mean, it's a very devastating situation.
President Taylor announced he will transfer presidential power to his vice president, Moses Blah, on Monday. Rebel leaders, however, say they won't relinquish control of Monrovia's port until Taylor is actually out of the country. Jason Bobian, NPR News, Monrovia.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrials gained 64 points to close at 9,126 in active trading of more than 1.3 billion shares. The Nasdaq lost a fraction to close at 1,652. This is NPR News. A group of Texas legislators filed a lawsuit today to allow them to return to Texas without fear of arrest. 11 Democratic state senators fled to Albuquerque, New Mexico, to block Republicans from redrawing Texas's congressional districts in a way that would give the Republicans a number of new seats in Congress. Texas Governor Rick Perry has asked the Texas Supreme Court to order the Democrats to return to the Capitol for a special session. The Democrats' lawsuit alleges that the governor has no authority to call a special session to draw new congressional boundaries. Federal health officials say cases of West Nile virus tripled in the last week, and they're warning that this year's outbreak may surpass last year's record numbers. NPR's Vicky Quay reports.
Researchers at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say so far 164 human cases of West Nile virus have been reported in 16 states. The hardest hit is Colorado, which is reporting 72 confirmed cases of the virus and one death. Researchers had warned the virus was spreading west, but they say they're surprised at the speed. They predict by the end of the fall, the virus will be detected in 48 states. West Nile virus tends to flare each year in August and continue through the fall. CDC Chief Julie Gerberding says nearly two-thirds of last year's record outbreak were reported after August. Last year at this time, there were 50 fewer cases reported in just four states. Vicky Quay, NPR News.
Consumer borrowing fell slightly in June as consumers faced a more uncertain labor market. The Federal Reserve said consumers cut back on borrowing by more than $400 million from the month before. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from AstraZeneca, makers of prescription Nexium, esomeprazole magnesium. Ask your doctor. Nexium, the purple pill, at purplepill.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is actress Hope Davis. She's best known for her starring roles in About Schmidt as Jack Nicholson's daughter and Next Stop Wonderland, in which she played a single woman who keeps striking out in her love life. Now she's starring in two new films, American Splendor, based on Harvey Pekar's autobiographical comic book series of the same name, and The Secret Lives of Dentists, which is adapted from Jane Smiley's novella, The Age of Grief. In The Secret Lives of Dentists, Davis and Campbell Scott play a married couple who have a joint dental practice and are raising three young daughters. The work and the children are very demanding, and the strain is showing in the marriage. Things get worse when Campbell Scott starts to suspect that his wife is having an affair with another man. But he's afraid that if he asks if that's true, he won't be able to bear the answer, so he says nothing, and she interprets his withdrawal as indifference. In this scene, she's watching TV and knitting in the living room. He walks in, sits on the arm of her chair, and starts kissing her.
Do you like me?
I love you.
I mean, if you weren't sleeping with me. Would you want to talk to me and have lunch with me and... You would?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I would.
Do you think that we're friends?
I'll prove it to you.
I thought it would be different, you know, our marriage. I thought it would be like the Cinerama. It would just get wider and wider, and it doesn't. It just gets smaller and smaller.
You play the mother of three. I've so often seen you as like the single woman, you know, the unmarried woman. Was this an interesting change for you?
Yeah. All of a sudden, everything that I'm being offered, I have kids. You know, in the Hollywood world, you hit that mid-30s and you're a mother, and then very soon you get to be the grandmother.
And then you get no roles at all.
Right. You know, I think Goldie Hawn said it best. She said something like there's the ingenue and district, and then you go to district attorney, and then it's Driving Miss Daisy. Those are the three ages of women in Hollywood. Now everything and with every passing year, at first I had three-year-olds, and suddenly I'm offered roles where I have teenage sons. I loved, you know, for me, I was pregnant at the time of filming this with my first child.
I thought so. I was going to ask you about that.
Oh, could you tell?
Well, it's not, I didn't see a stomach on you. You know, you didn't look pregnant, but you were wearing pregnant cover-up clothes.
Oh, yes.
You know, long sweaters, big coats.
The long sweaters and trying to gesture a lot in front of my stomach and, yeah. It was very interesting to be with three very young girls on the set. It was so daunting to me. These girls had more energy than the entire crew put together, and they were so noisy and so full of life and so wonderfully rambunctious that I was sitting there, you know, feeling heavy with morning sickness and just wondering how on earth I was going to do this. But it was kind of interesting to kind of see the future there for myself.
But that's funny because that's in a way what the adult characters are feeling too. Like they obviously love their kids, but their kids
are completely overwhelmed by them.
Exactly, they're such a handful.
Which is something that, you know, that's another thing that I love about the film. I was one of three girls, and I saw my parents struggle with these same things. How do you keep your relationship alive when 99% of your energy is spent trying to pay the mortgage and trying to get the food on the table and trying to clean up the breakfast and getting the kids dressed, and then one kid has a fever and then five people have a fever? And how do you keep your, you know, the spark of your marriage alive through this kind of daily grind? And I love that about the movie. I love the way it explores that.
I have to ask you about American Splendor. I think this is really a special movie. It's based on the autobiographical comics of Harvey Pekar. Now, he's somebody who never really supported himself from his comics. He worked until his retirement as a file clerk. He's a jazz record collector and also writes music criticism. He's very obsessive-compulsive, very self-absorbed, cynical, difficult to get along with, or at least that's how he is in his autobiographical comics. You play Joyce Brabner, a woman who worked in a comic book store and then wrote to Harvey asking for copies of American Splendor. They started up a correspondence. He invited her to Cleveland to meet him, and they ended up getting married a few days later. So you play Joyce Brabner, the woman who becomes his wife. Let me play a scene from your first dinner together in Cleveland at a restaurant.
Oh, great.
You're not happy with the restaurant. Paul Giamatti plays Harvey Pekar.
What's wrong?
Nothing.
Something's wrong. You keep looking around everywhere.
I guess I never imagined you'd eat in a place like this.
What, me? No, I've never been here. I thought you'd like it. But obviously you don't, do you?
It's fine. What difference does it make?
I don't know. None, I guess. You got a lot of meat on this menu.
You're a vegetarian?
Kinda, you know. I mean, ever since I got a pet cat, you know, I've had a lot of trouble eating animals.
I support and identify with groups like PETA, but unfortunately, I'm a self-diagnosed anemic. Also, I have all these food allergies to vegetables, which give me serious intestinal distress. I guess I have a lot of borderline health disorders that limit me politically when it comes to eating.
Wow, you're a sick woman.
Not yet, but I expect to be. Everyone in my family has some sort of degenerative illness.
That's Hope Davis and Paul Giamatti in a scene from American Splendor, which is based on the story of Harvey Pekar and Joyce Brabner. That's a great scene and an example of how you have to play the character of Joyce. There's a lot of comedy in this because the characters are so neurotic and so self-involved.
Mm-hmm.
But you play it not for laughs. Do you know what? You play it very straight.
Yeah, I mean, this is the only way to do this type of comedy. I actually, right before I made American Splendor, the movie I'd done just before that was about Schmidt, and Jack Nicholson gave us, a really good talking to before we started that movie about how if we played it for laughs, you know, all of the very subtle bits of comedy go right out the window. So, you know, I've never forgotten that. And certainly in a movie like American Splendor, these people don't think they're funny. They don't think what they have to say is remotely funny. They think it's very serious, and that's the only way to play it. Paul Giamatti and I actually had a really tough time doing that scene. When we read it about 2 hours before we were supposed to start shooting it, we could not stop laughing. We were laughing so hard, we were sweating, and we were so nervous that we were going to be laughing during the shooting because this had been a problem over the course of the film, that we went into my trailer and we rehearsed the thing into the ground, and we came out and performed it, and the directors came at us. They were horrified. It was like a funeral dirge. We'd taken it down so low, and they were panicked. They came at us. They were like, "You've got to liven it up." But we were desperately trying not to laugh. I think the writing is so brilliant in this film.
So was that the version that you used, the funeral version?
No, believe it or not, you're seeing the warmed-up version.
Okay. Now, one of the things that makes this movie really unique is that there's you and Paul Giamatti playing Harvey Pekar and Joyce Brabner, but at the same time, there's documentary scenes with Harvey Pekar and Joyce Brabner talking about themselves and being interviewed. And there's also stills from the comic book that are shown. So it's working on three levels at the same time, something that could be a really terrible failure very easily, but for some reason, it really works. And it's very true to the sensibility of the comic. But anyways, you know, people often play parts in which their role is based on a real person, but people very rarely play a part in which the real person joins them in the movie. So what were you up against playing Joyce Brabner, knowing that Joyce was actually going to be representing herself in the movie as well?
She was also standing beside the camera on my first day of shooting.
Oh, no.
I was very, very nervous to play. You know, I think it was the most nervous I've ever been shooting a film because Joyce took me aside a couple days before the filming started and said that she was really unhappy with the way she was always portrayed in Harvey's comic book. She didn't feel it was her whole true character, and she was not so sure she liked the script and the way she was portrayed in the script, and she really wanted to be represented in a more well-rounded way. And so Joyce is, as you can see from in the film, she's a rather intimidating character. And I started the first day, and I could see her standing next to the camera with her eyes folded, and she had her glasses on, and she was peering down her nose at me. And I became so nervous. I just felt like such a fraud that I felt that I was acting very poorly. So after the first take, I took the directors aside, and I said, please, please, please ask her not to watch. I can't do it. I can't perform. So she didn't watch the rest of the filming, and she was pretty peeved about that. She really wanted to be there. Harvey, on the other hand, hung around the set all day, every day, and seemed completely bored by the whole enterprise. He didn't understand why it took so long to do everything. His favorite thing was the big lunch spread, the free lunch spread that came at about 2 o'clock every day. He'd hang around for that, but he thought the filming was kind of silly.
Well, and go ahead.
Then he saw the finished film, and I think he's pretty happy.
Had you read American Splendor before taking the role?
I had not read American Splendor. I'd heard about it, and I had not read the comic books, and I actually got all of the comic books before I read the script, and by the time I'd finished the first comic book, I desperately wanted to do the film. I was so in love with Harvey's writing and those stories that he writes.
What did you like about the comic?
Well, they actually kind of reminded me of Joseph Mitchell's writings. I'd done a film with Stanley Tucci, Joe Gould's Secret, about Joseph Mitchell, who wrote for The New Yorker, and just captured the lives of these New Yorkers, you know, these people that you would never encounter in high society, or, you know, the ticket taker at the theater window at the Bowery. And I felt like Harvey really tapped into the same vein of expression. You know, he's telling the stories, these very kind of stories about these seemingly ordinary people, and yet they're all kind of poets in their own way. And I was really taken with his ability to take the most mundane activity and describe the conversation that took place therein and just make you realize how beautiful it is the way people will just talk about the most mundane things just to have a conversation, just to connect, just to talk. And I was just fascinated with his work.
That's a really interesting comparison between Joseph Mitchell and Harvey Pekar.
Yeah, I think they would get along.
So you know, I don't think I asked you what kind of feedback Joyce Brabner gave you on the performance when she saw the final film.
Well, we saw the film together at the Sundance Film Festival at its first screening, which was a really exciting evening. You know, I didn't know how the film would be received. I'd seen it alone in a screening room and didn't know how I felt about it. It's, you know, the first time I see a film, I always feel very strange afterwards. And the filming, the screening was just, they ate it up. And the audience laughed at almost anything that came out of the character's mouth, Joyce's mouth. And afterwards, she was just absolutely beaming. And we went up afterwards to do a Q&A, and I wondered if Joyce was going to be shy. You know, I hadn't seen her. She went straight up to that microphone and took over, and she was hilarious. And it was clear that she was just, she was so happy with the way people received the film.
So she felt they were laughing with the character and not
absolutely
at her?
She thought they were laughing at Harvey and with her.
And what did Harvey think?
You know, at the end of the screening, the audience stood up when they saw that Harvey and Joyce were there, and they stood up and applauded and stood for a long time. And Harvey was just, it was so sweet. He just was shuffling his feet in front of the crowd and looking at the floor, and he had this big grin on his face. And I just felt like this is Harvey's moment in the sun, and by God, he deserves it. He's a poet.
He's one of the great unrecognized, or under-recognized, I should say.
I think so. Yeah. I think so. And I really feel like our culture could use Harvey Pekar at this point. You know, he just says exactly what's on his mind, and it's I love to listen to him talk.
My guest is actress Hope Davis. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actress Hope Davis. She starred in About Schmidt, Next Stop Wonderland, and Day Trippers. She's starring in two new films, The Secret Lives of Dentists and American Splendor. Now, you work with Jack Nicholson in About Schmidt. He played your father. What was his style of working and rehearsing? Was there anything different about working with him than outside of his fame than other actors that you've worked with?
Well, there was just the, you know, the kind of heightened, you know, the adrenaline rushing sitting across from Jack Nicholson feeling. We didn't rehearse on that film, that's the way that I like to do it. And we kind of showed up and, you know, we did one read-through of the script and then we showed up, figured out where we were going to sit and launched. And I have to say, it was thrilling to sit across the table from him and work. He's an actor's actor. He absolutely relishes diving into scenes and fleshing them out and telling these stories. And it was like being on a roller coaster. I was so excited sitting across the table and working with him. It was, you know, I still can't believe it happened. It was like a dream for me. I loved every minute of it.
I could see, even though you've been in a lot of films, I could see the possibility of you feeling slightly intimidated by him just because he's so at the top of acting.
Yeah.
But did you get the impression from him that it doesn't work for him to have actors being intimidated when they're working with him? Did he try to do anything to dispel any discomfort you might have?
Well, in a wonderful way, he didn't go out of his way to make everybody feel like he was just one of the guys, because he's not one of the guys. He's Jack Nicholson. He's probably the coolest, you know, he's not your average guy, and he knows that, and there's something kind of magical about him. So he doesn't try to pal around with people, and yet he made me feel comfortable the second we stepped on set by just, you know, the first scene we did, we were in our bathrobes, and he had his hair standing up, and he had his little bathrobe wrapped around him, and he was so, just being in his presence, he was so warm and sweet, and he was Warren Schmidt right away. He was my dad. He was the dad. And he was so into the moment of doing the scene that all the other stuff fell away the second we started reading the scenes, because he's, you know, that's what he's there to do. All the other, you know, hullabaloo that surrounds being an actor or being a big star like that just falls away when the camera's rolling and you're shooting. And I was so happy to see that it was going to be like that.
The funny thing is, here you are in scenes with Jack Nicholson, but you're the one who's angry with him in it. You're the one who's trying to tell him what to do.
Yeah, people always said, oh, was it scary to yell at him and Jack Nicholson? No, it was absolutely great. You know, because it seemed so very real to sit across. And, you know, strangely enough, he reminded me of my dad, you know, a guy who didn't know how to make a sandwich and had no idea where the washer and dryer were. And, you know, that was my dad. And I just, you know, I really could relate to him in that way. And how infuriating it is to sit across from a man who's 65 and doesn't know where the potato chips are kept, you know.
What's your favorite scene in the film that you're in?
I love the wedding scene, you know, only a little bit of which is actually shown in the film. We filmed a long wedding scene. I just love the scene at the table when she's made him the sandwich and they have their first big talk. You know, it's clear that they haven't had a talk in a really long time and it doesn't go very well. And I loved shooting that scene, and I love watching him in it. I think he's amazing.
Why don't we hear that scene then?
Great.
This is Hope Davis and Jack Nicholson in a scene from About Schmidt.
Dad? Why did you get such a cheap casket?
What?
I could tell you got the cheapest casket. Everybody could.
Oh, that is not true. That is not true. I specifically did not choose, as you say, the cheapest casket. There was one less expensive which they showed me, and I refused it.
You mean a pine box?
Well, I don't remember what it was.
She waited on you hand and foot. Couldn't you have splurged on her just once?
Jack Nicholson and my guest Hope Davis in a scene from About Schmidt. How did you get interested in acting?
I grew up in suburban New Jersey, and every Sunday my parents drove the three of us, we three girls, into the city, and we would do something really fun. We would go to a museum, or we would go down to Times Square, which was really dirty, and it was really exciting to be there, and we'd get Greek food and go home. And then once or twice a year, we would have a really big outing, and we would go to the theater, and or we would go to see the New York City Ballet. And those were the most exciting afternoons of my life. And I think when I was 11 or 12, my parents came in to see A Chorus Line, and we weren't allowed to go because it was way too racy for us. And they brought home that big, colorful program with all the pictures in it, and they also brought home the record. And I think I spent the next 4 or 5 years dancing around the living room, singing my heart out about, you know, I gotta dance, I gotta sing, I've gotta do it. And I do think I'm an actress because of a chorus line. And I was just really bitten by the passion with which they were singing and dancing. And it was the first thing that I did that really made my heart pound and made my blood rush and made me really, really excited. I always loved, you know, when I was in high school and I had drama class, when I would walk toward that door of that drama class, my heart would be thumping and I'd start sweating. And, you know, it was just the only thing that really, really tickled me. And I never thought that I would actually do it for a living. That never occurred to me. I'm still kind of amazed that people let me do that for a living. It's a great job if you can get it.
When was the last time you listened to the cast recording of A Chorus Line?
My husband is a big maker of mixtapes, and I think we've got a couple of the songs and some mixtapes. So I heard a couple of them in the car in the last couple of months.
Still sound good?
Oh, it's a brilliant musical. It sounds fantastic still.
Hope Davis is starring in two new movies, American Splendor and The Secret Lives of Dentists. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
One singular sensation, every little step she takes. One.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the National Endowment for the Arts, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with actress Hope Davis. Ken Tucker concludes his series on pop rock bands with a review of The High Strung. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers what's wrong with the way most modern dictionaries are illustrated. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Hope Davis. She's starring in two new movies, American Splendor, based on the autobiographical comic book series by Harvey Pekar, and The Secret Lives of Dentists, adapted from the Jane Smiley novella, The Age of Grief. Davis played Jack Nicholson's daughter in About Schmidt and starred in the film Next Stop Wonderland. Now, I read that you had auditioned for Baywatch.
Oh, jeez.
I was thinking, what was she thinking? You seem so not Baywatch.
Well, that's what they said to me. You know, I definitely was of the mind when I started in this business that you should never pass up any opportunity because you never knew when you'd get a job. I mean, the things that I've auditioned for over my career, you know, people always say, oh, how have you picked such... I've auditioned for, you know, everything under the sun. And when they said go in for Baywatch, I think I was 24. I was excited. I thought, wow, run around on a beach in a bathing suit. This would be really fun. I thought I actually might get the job. And I went in. I think I got cut on the very first weed through. I think I was plucked out.
Was there an audition?
No, they just literally stood us in a row and
looked at your breasts.
Down. Yeah, you know. I was slumped over in some, you know, Putumayo dress with my, you know, with my lace-up pioneer boots on.
not right for the part.
No, I think it was my first trip to California too. My skin was way too covered. I was way overdressed.
Oh, and you're so pale.
I was so pale, and I'd been living in Chicago, and I was gray and pale, and deep shadows under my eyes, and my long dress. I didn't know what I was thinking.
What are some of the other strangest roles or auditions?
Well, I think I came kind of close to getting Christina Applegate's job in Married with Children.
Really?
That would have changed my whole career.
You seem too old for that.
Yeah, I think that's in the end why I didn't. But, you know, this was 15 years ago that I think that show started.
True, right.
And, you know, when I was 25, I looked younger than I was. And I think it was my first television audition that I went in on, and I sat in the room with the director, and I read, and he said thank you, and I said thanks, like great. When do we start? Do we go right to California? I was so naive. I think I did get a call back or two for that, but I didn't get the job.
Did you do commercials?
I never did commercials. I tried a couple times. I think the last commercial I auditioned for was for Newprint or something, and, you know, when you have to say little, yellow, different. And I had the pill in my hand. I looked at the camera, and I said, little, yellow, different. And the cashier, she just looked at me, and she started laughing, and she said, you know, this is never, you should never, ever, ever try to sell anything. No one will buy anything from you. I just didn't have the knack.
What did she mean by that?
I just think I wasn't able to be perky about the little pill.
No, but in your movies, you play somebody who needs a little pill.
I know. That's the point. Right.
So you're supposed to need the little pill, but look really perky and happy.
You can't
anyways.
Look like you really need the pill when you're selling the pill.
Got it. Now, your first leading role was in Day Trippers in 1996. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning of the film, your husband, played by Stanley Tucci, has left. And the rest of the film is basically the family trying to track him down and figure out what went wrong. And then the first film in which you were the romantic lead was Next Stop Wonderland. And in this film, in the opening scene, your boyfriend, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, walks out on you because he's become this environmental activist. And he's going to South America to help rescue indigenous peoples there.
Yeah.
And your mother so desperately wants you to be happy, and she's so unhappy that, thinking this will help, she takes out a personal ad on your behalf in which you're described as, what is it, carefree?
Right. Spunky and carefree or something.
Yeah, and fun-loving.
Fun-loving.
Which is so not your character,
not
your
my
personality.
Character.
And so you're really angry with your mother, and you're embarrassed to have your presence in a personal ad. Nevertheless, you decide to follow up on it and meet some of the guys who are responding to it. And there's this great scene that kind of edits together a bunch of these first encounters. So I thought we could play an excerpt of that scene in which you're meeting your dates for the first time.
Okay.
You know, you don't say a lot, but it's pretty obvious what you're telling me.
Really?
Your body language says it all. You're palming me.
I'm sorry?
You're palming me. Your palms are exposed to me. When a woman does that, she's subconsciously flirting.
Yeah, what does this mean?
Tiger.
Let's just sum up here, okay? God is definitely a woman. He because only a woman would have the kind of compassion necessary to create someone as beautiful as you.
Okay, there's one giant hole in your argument.
Hole?
Daryl. No female deity would have had the absence of mind to create you, the male gender, a gender that spends all of its time looking forward to getting off. God is a man. Why? Because men need women. Women don't need men.
And yet you're here. It's the hole in your argument.
That's my guest Hope Davis in a scene from Next Stop Wonderland. Hope Davis, what did you like about the script when you read it?
Well, I was going through a really bad time in my life, and I so identified with this woman feeling absolutely alone and like she'd never love and be loved. I'd been through a terrible divorce, and I was on my own in New York City, and just, you know, I'd gone on a date or two and just felt like, well, that's it. I'm a spinster. I'm giving up. It's over for me. I don't want to do this. I don't like men. I don't want to do this. And then the script came along, and I met with the director, and I said, you don't understand. This is me right now. I identify with every piece of this character. And it was a time when, you know, the script and my life really coincided. I look back at it now, and, it's definitely a dark time.
I'm sure one part that did not coincide was the personal ads. I bet you didn't take one out.
Well, this I definitely understood that, but I would never take it. I would be, you would never take out a personal ad. Although I actually did meet my husband, my current wonderful husband, on a blind date.
How did you feel about a blind date?
I was horrified. I was terrified. I just thought I just thought it was just the worst possible idea, and that it would never work. And in fact, the moment I saw my future husband, I just took one look at him and said, nope, no, not, nope. I don't like anything about him. No way. Plus, he's not tall enough for me. They need to be at least 6'4". That's what I like. And I was just terrified at the idea of, meeting someone in that way. But, boy, I got very lucky.
What was so wrong about him on first meeting?
Well, he got really dressed up for our first date, and we still joke about the outfit that he wore. He had saddle shoes on, which haven't been in for maybe 20 years. And I took one look at those saddle shoes. You know I'm a New Yorker, and he also had a red windbreaker on, and I just thought, my God, never. And he just looked sweet, and that was not the type that I liked. I liked them really angry and mean and tortured. I just thought he looked way too sweet and wonderful.
And did he throw away the saddle shoes when you started seeing each other?
I made him throw them away.
And
about a year after being together for about a year.
The red windbreaker.
We still have that actually. We still like to look at that now and then.
My guest is actress Hope Davis. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Hope Davis, and she's in two new movies, American Splendor and The Secret Lives of Dentists. Her other movies include About Schmidt, Next Stop Wonderland, and Day Trippers. You lived across the street when you were young from the Sorvino family, actor Paul Sorvino and his daughter Mira Sorvino. Was he acting when you lived across from the family?
Oh, yes. He was acting and he was singing opera and, they moved onto the street and everyone on the block was always watching what they were doing because he would go outside in his bathrobe and you could hear him singing opera and they made pasta all the time and they were loud and he would go into New York. I think he was doing championship season when we were living across the street and, a car would come at night and take him into New York and everyone on the block was very excited to be living near them.
Did that make you feel more that acting was in reach for you because you saw somebody in the neighborhood who was actually doing it?
Oh, no. I never dreamed that I could be an actress, a performer. I was just kind of mesmerized with seeing someone do this kind of incredible thing. I mean, in the morning I would watch all the dads hustle up the street to the 734 bus to get into New York. And then at night there was Paul Sorvino in a black you know, sedan would come and whisk him into the city, and then he'd come home at midnight and you could hear him singing. I think it's probably what made it seem very exciting to me, but it never occurred to me that I could, you know, be part of that.
What did your dad do for a living?
What did Dad do for a living? My father did a bunch of different things. He's someone who, you know, I think part of the reason the Secret Lives of Dentists movie appealed to me is I definitely saw my father as someone who got kind of trapped into, you know, he had to pay the mortgage and take care of three girls, and he really would have rather been flying airplanes and traveling and doing his own thing. He was a salesman for a while. He was a very smart man. He was a chemical engineer, and he invented a bunch of different things. He enjoyed drinking. He did different things.
Was drinking a big problem?
Oh, sure.
And did that scare you as a kid, watching your father have a personality change when he drank?
I don't know if he really had a personality change, because he liked to drink, you know, from sometimes early in the day until late in the evening. He was a very sweet man. He wasn't a man who, you know, would get drunk and get angry. But it definitely made me aware that that he felt trapped, and that, you know, I didn't want to feel that way when I was an adult. I wanted a lifestyle that would not make me feel like I was a prisoner in any way.
Are your parents still married?
No, my parents divorced when I was in my 20s, and my father died about 6 years ago.
Oh. Does that make it more comfortable for you to say something about him?
He was never a person that, you know, that hid anything. Yeah, sure. I probably wouldn't want to talk about it if he was still alive.
Now, you went to Vassar. Was Vassar still, like, predominantly a women's school when you were there?
No. It was, they were probably, it was 55% women and 45% men. Hmm. And as a matter of fact, Meryl Streep had gone to Vassar, which I didn't know at the time that I enrolled. It wasn't until I was in college that I kind of fell in love with her. And I had a great time at Vassar. It was quite a luxury to go to college in my family. It wasn't a given. And, you know, by that point, my mother was supporting all three of us. And it was a big deal to get the money together to go to college. And I relished every minute of it. And I got a great education there. I didn't study drama. I did that kind of just as an extracurricular thing. And I just loved every second of my time there.
What did you study?
I majored in cognitive science.
Huh.
What? It's a multidisciplinary approach to thinking. How do people think? I mean, now it's become quite a popular science, but when I majored in it in college, it was kind of a new term. So it was very exciting for me.
Anything helpful that you can draw on from that in acting?
Not a thing. although I do remember that my senior thesis was ridiculously titled a neocognitive scientific interpretation of the imagination. So I guess I was trying to delve into the mind of the actor then. But you know, I think the thing I took most from college was that it was great to get an education and to read some books, because this profession can just be mind numbing at times, and it was kind of good to start out with a good base.
What movies do you have coming up in addition to Secret Lives of Dentists and American Splendor?
Those are the only things I have in the can, as they say. I had a baby, and so I've taken some time off. I'm actually leaving tomorrow to go to South Africa to make a movie with Carol Ballard, who's a wonderful director who made Black Stallion and Fly Away Home about the geese, and the beautiful movie about the Canadian geese. And it's a movie about a boy and his cheetah, and I'm his mother. And I'm very, very excited to go to South Africa.
Another mother role.
Yes. I'm happy to do it now that I'm a mother. I'm happy to do it.
Right. And you can take your child with you?
Yes, my husband and child, we're all going.
Oh, that's great. Well, have a great trip.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Hope Davis is starring in two new movies, The Secret Lives of Dentists and About Schmidt. In the last few weeks, rock critic Ken Tucker has been surveying the current crop of pop rock bands. Today he concludes his series with The High Strung, a Brooklyn-based band formed in Detroit that Ken says makes nerdy unhappiness sound like something close to bliss.
Wretched boys, wretched boys. That's what so much pop rock sung by young white males boils down to, doesn't it? The Brooklyn quartet The High Strung, led by tense harmonizers Mark Owen and Josh Mallerman, are young enough to make that song about parental strife sound both vivid and bratty. They're also pros enough to have shaped their 13-song debut CD into a sustained joyride of giddiness, depression, and artfully shredded guitar chords. And on this song, I Got Frustration, The High Strung makes their discovery of 70s punk rock exhilaratingly vehement. If there's one thing we've learned in listening to the batch of current bands who've assimilated the Beatles and the Ramones and Cheap Trick as though they were all their randy uncles, the genre coheres around a sense of feeling both naughty and alienated. Alienated from the current trends in music. Alienated from sexual confidence. Alienated from emotions that extend much far beyond cheerful miserableness to angry miserableness. It's an intentionally limited range, played primarily with guitars and drums, limited to certain chords and time signatures. But like a good sonnet or a good TV commercial, the new pop rock has great formal pleasures. The structure of a concise puzzle that, when assembled into verse, chorus, verse, the refrain locks into place and is intensely satisfying, both to the listener and, I would imagine, to the players themselves. These Are Good Times is the title of The High Strung's first full-length album. You might be tempted to hear that title as ironic, but you shouldn't. No matter how many times the vocals curl into whines or the lyrics bemoan a botched or unconsummated romance, the unreliable narrator, as they say in writing class, is thrilled at letting off steam, at having come up with a tune that encapsulates the pent-up energy that gives all of this music and all of the pop rock bands I've been reviewing over the past few weeks their jolt, their kick, their joy.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg on the part of dictionaries you don't think much about, the illustrations. This is Fresh Air. We think of dictionaries as books of words, but as our linguist Jeff Nunberg observes, the pictures matter too.
Many years ago, someone passed on to me a 7-volume set of the 1907 Grand Larousse Dictionary. The books are all pretty tattered by now, but they're still glorious with their dark red covers embossed with trees and gold letters, their Art Nouveau frontispieces and letter pages, and above all, their intricate engravings and maps and resplendent color plates, plates of animals, birds, and insects, plates of costumes and furniture, and lots of plates of military uniforms. That's the same dictionary that Jean-Paul Sartre recounts reading as a child in his autobiographical novel, The Words. "The Grand Larousse was everything to me," he writes. "I would take down a volume at random behind the desk on the next-to-last shelf. Each volume seemed to denote a different department of universal knowledge. There was the C through D region, the P through Z region, each with its flora and fauna, its cities, its great men, and its battles. Men and beasts were there in person, the engravings were their bodies, the texts was their souls, their unique essences." That's not an experience a child is likely to have nowadays. Whatever virtues most of our dictionaries have, they aren't books to take us lands away. They may include a handful of color plates, but they're basically textual affairs. The illustrations serve mostly to break the unrelieved monotony of the columns of type. Still, those dictionaries do have their visual charms. And it was nice to see a piece in the Sunday New York Times magazine the other day on Jeffrey Middleton, who's the illustrator of the new 11th edition of Merriam-Webster's Collegiate. Middleton is responsible for the elegant little pen and ink drawings inserted every couple of pages or so alongside the entries. It's a style that hasn't much changed in the past 75 years. Dictionary traditionalists argue that those drawings do a better job of rendering the idea of a word than elaborate plates or photographs could. As the American lexicographer Sidney Landau once put it, "Photographs are necessarily of unidealized individual things, whereas drawings can represent a composite distillation." That says as much about the popular conception of photography as it does about dictionaries. It's a fair bet that Pierre Larousse would have used photographs in his grand dictionary if he'd had the technology to print them properly. In that age, people didn't have any problem thinking of photographs as the representations of abstract ideas or imaginary settings. Victorian photographers like Fallon Horn and Henry Peach Robinson produced staged allegories and dramatic scenes with titles like Youth and Age or The Two Ways of Life. Julia Cameron did photographic illustrations for Tennyson's The Idylls of the King, and Henry James allowed the use of photographs to illustrate a 1909 edition of The Golden Bowl. It wasn't until the early 20th century that people began to think of photography as a pure record of the concrete facts before the lens. For Paul Strand, André Kertész, or Henri Cartier-Bresson, there could be no photographs but of things. As Strand once said, "The camera machine cannot evade the objects that are in front of it." Within a few decades, the idea of photographing abstract ideas brought to mind the kitschy propaganda photos that the Nazis and Soviets made with titles like Sunday Volunteers or The Next Generation. And modernist might allow you to make a film of a novel, but you couldn't use stills from it as illustrations when the book was reissued. And even today, no American dictionary uses photographs to illustrate the meanings of words apart from the American Heritage. I should say that I'm associated with that dictionary, though they keep me pretty far from the art department end of things. Yet contemporary photographers put those austere modernist scruples behind them some time ago. Fabulists like Joel Peter Witkin, surrealists like Sandy Skoglund, narrative photographers like Tina Barney or Sam Taylor Wood, all of them take the object in front of the lens as standing in for something other than itself. I like to imagine some avant-garde Grand Larousse of the far future that's illustrated with modern photographs like Cindy Sherman's depictions of herself in the guise of a housewife or a Raphael, or the photographs that Laurie Simmons calls food, clothing, and shelter, where figurines of leggy women wear hot dogs, gloves, and houses on their upper bodies like the dancing cigarette packs in the old gold commercials of the 50s. But the problem with the way most modern dictionaries are illustrated isn't what they imply about photography, but what they imply about words. They leave you with the impression that words are these colorless abstractions at an eternal remove from the concrete realm of the senses. You think of the angels in Wim Wenders' film Wings of Desire, who float in black and white above the streets of Berlin and never make contact with sensory experience. But when you hear words like bagel or bullfrog, what comes to mind isn't a sketchy silhouette. Meanings are part of the world, too, and they have color and texture and form just like everything else. You can even take pictures of them.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University's Center for the Study of Language and Information, and he's the author of The Way We Talk Now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with the original version of Tennessee Waltz. It was co-written by bandleader and accordion player Pee Wee King and the singer and fiddler Henry Red Stewart. Stewart died Monday at the age of 82. Here's their 1947 recording of Tennessee Waltz.
Darling, to the Tennessee Waltz, when an old friend I happened to see. I introduced him to my loved one, and while they were dancing, my friend stole my sweetheart from me. I remember the night and the Tennessee Waltz. Only you know how much I have lost. Yes, I lost my little darling the night they were playing the beautiful Tennessee Waltz. My darling, to the Tennessee Waltz, when an old friend I happened to see. I introduced him to my loved one, and while they were dancing, my friend stole my sweetheart.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Pink Slip, a novel about love, work, and family by Rita Cerisi, author of Remind Me Again Why I Married You. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, comic and actor Dennis Leary. This Sunday, he gets roasted on Comedy Central. He's also one of the stars of the new film, The Secret Lives of Dentists. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.